Stories that define our lives.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
The views expressed in this program belong solely to the persons expressing them and do not necessarily represent the opinions of KPFT or the Pacifica Foundation.
Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston at 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community radio. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. At my website, thinkwingradio.com, I link to all the articles I read and cite, as well as other relevant sources. Articles and commentaries often include lots of internet links for those of you who want to dig deeper. Trump's National Guard troops have finally been removed from Los Angeles under a court order. Nonetheless, it's the 19th week of Trump's military occupation of Washington, D.C., 10 weeks since Trump deployed National Guard troops to Memphis, Tennessee, and an ongoing federal law enforcement occupation in Chicago. There have been various court rulings that these military actions in U.S. cities are illegal under the Posse Comitatus Act, but our lawless regime is still resisting compliance. To be continued. In runoff election results for Harris County, Alejandra Salinas has won the remainder of the term of Houston City Council at large position 4. Renee Jefferson Patterson has won the position of HCC Trustee District 2. From the Texas Tribune, Governor Greg Abbott has a sweeping plan to abolish Texas's school property taxes. Would it work? Texas lawmakers have gone big to rein in the state's property taxes, spending tens of billions of dollars toward reducing the annual bill homeowners and businesses pay each year to help pay for schools. State lawmakers have also put tighter limits on how much local governments can increase taxes to pay for public safety, parks, and other services. Ahead of the 2026 election, Governor Greg Abbott wants to go bigger. The three-term governor's signature proposal is a sweeping property tax cut platform. On Abbott's tax cut agenda, getting rid of the school property taxes for homeowners, putting tighter limits on how much property values can rise, and making it tougher for local governments to raise taxes even as their regions boom. Abbott told a crowd at a campaign event Thursday in Fort Worth, touting the platform, quote, "Every single year, you, my constituents, keep saying our property taxes are too high. We have to do more to lower them," unquote. So far, several Texas House lawmakers have signed on to the platform. Some prominent conservative groups like the Texas Public Policy Foundation and Americans for Prosperity, too, have embraced the plan. Said James Quintero, policy director at the conservative Texas Public Policy Foundation's Taxpayer Protection Project, quote, "The governor's proposals promise to radically improve the tax system's affordability and predictability by limiting local spending growth, protecting home ownership, and empowering everyday Texans to hold tax cut elections. With the governor's plan in place, Texans will finally be able to breathe easy," unquote. However, tax policy experts spanning the political spectrum are skeptical that Abbott's pitch is realistic or would meaningfully bring down the state's high tax bills. Adam Langley, associate director of tax policy at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, said of Abbott's platform, quote, "This is basically a collection of the worst types of policies meant to constrain property taxes. The negatives here definitely outweigh the positives, and there are a lot of good policy options out there that are missing as well," unquote. Cutting property taxes has proven tricky for state lawmakers. Texas doesn't levy a statewide property tax. Nonetheless, Texans pay among the highest property taxes in the country, in part because the state doesn't have an income tax and cities, states, counties, and school districts rely heavily on property taxes to pay for public schools, police officers, and firefighters, among other public services. Any of Abbott's ideas would have to get the green light from lawmakers in the Texas legislature, where similar ideas have failed. At the very least, tax cut proponents are treating Abbott's platform as a conversation starter around how to wrangle the state's high property taxes. Perhaps the most eye-popping proposal in Abbott's platform is allowing Texas voters to decide whether to abolish school property taxes on homeowners, a goal long pursued by the state's diehard conservatives. Abbott says the state is collecting enough revenue to backfill the money schools would no longer collect from homeowners. School districts have long accounted for the biggest chunk of a given property owner's tax bill, and state lawmakers have spent billions of dollars in recent years with the intent of driving down homeowners' school taxes. In November, Texas voters expanded the state's homestead exemption, or the amount of a homeowner's primary residence's value that can't be taxed to pay for public schools, from $100,000 to $140,000. Voters approved even bigger breaks for homeowners age 65 and over and those with disabilities. Such moves have made a dent, but haven't come close to eliminating school property taxes for most homeowners. Abolishing property taxes altogether is an idea that's caught on in conservative circles in recent years as the state boomed and housing costs skyrocketed, but the idea has often run into a brick wall, including from Republicans. One reason why? Doing so would be enormously costly. Replacing all school property taxes would have cost the state $39.5 billion in tax year 2023 alone, the Legislative Budget Board, a joint legislative committee that helps lawmakers write the state's budget, said last year. School districts collected more in 2024 to the tune of $42 billion. For comparison, the portion of the state budget paid for with state taxes in tax year 2023 was $58.8 billion. The state already plans to spend $51 billion over the next 2 years on school property tax cuts. Those funds will pay for the bump in the homestead exemption as well as targeted cuts for businesses. The state will also send a good portion of those funds to local school districts to replace revenue that otherwise would have been collected via property taxes with the aim of driving down school district tax rates. Had those measures been in effect last year, the owner of a typical Texas home, valued at $302,000, according to Zillow, would have saved more than $500 on their 2024 school taxes, according to a Tribune calculation. But $51 billion is a substantial chunk of money. For every $6 or $7 the state will spend in the next 2 years, one will be spent on cutting property taxes, a figure that has some budget wonks and even some Republicans worry may not be financially sustainable. Said Shannon Halbrook, a fiscal policy expert at Every Texan, a left-leaning policy nonprofit, abolishing property taxes for homeowners may be part of Abbott's platform, quote, for the purpose of messaging, but it is not a realistic proposal, unquote. Abbott's proposal would cost less than that because it would only apply to homeowners, the governor said Thursday. Abbott's campaign did not provide estimates of how much the proposal would cost, but school districts collected about $17.5 billion in taxes from homeowners of single-family homes in tax year 2023, according to an analysis by the Texas Taxpayers and Research Association, a business-backed group that lobbies for tax cuts. That figure includes taxes on rental homes, which don't qualify for homestead exemption, so they wouldn't be taken off the tax rolls. Owners of other property, like apartments, stores, factories, and warehouses, would still have to pay school property taxes, a fact likely to rile business groups. A push by Abbott and other GOP officials to drastically hike the state sales tax to pay for property tax cuts in 2019 went down in flames. That proposal, critics argued at the time, would have meant paying for property tax cuts on the backs of lower-income Texans who spend a bigger chunk of their income paying sales taxes than wealthier households. Texas would have had to more than double the state sales tax to replace all school property taxes in tax year 2023, another Texas Taxpayers and Research Association calculation found. Rather than touching the rate, it's possible state lawmakers could raise the amount of sales tax revenue the state generates by nixing certain exemptions and taxing more services, some experts said. But that would only generate so much revenue, Halbrook said.
Halbrook continued, "That really picks you up $1 billion here and there. It would not touch what they'd have to try and make up for if they completely got rid of taxes that pay to operate and maintain schools. This time, a sales tax hike is off the table," Abbott said Thursday. Abbott said, quote, "There's no reason to raise our sales taxes. We've got the money to reduce property taxes right now," unquote. Instead, Abbott said, state lawmakers would tap state budget surpluses to abolish homeowners' school property taxes. That's what state lawmakers have done the past 2 years to pay for tax cuts, drawing on surpluses created with tens of billions of dollars of federal COVID-19 pandemic dollars and higher than usual growth in sales taxes fueled by inflation. But state budget watchers have warned that those surpluses were an anomaly, and as those federal dollars have been spent and sales tax revenue wanes, lawmakers will likely not have as much wiggle room as they did in previous years. Abbott is undeterred, confident that the state's continued growth will keep at least some amount of surplus in the mix. Abbott said, quote, "When you look at our economy and know how diverse our economy is, you know that we're going to have plenty of money for a long time," unquote. Abbott has proposed amending the Texas Constitution to get rid of homeowners' school taxes, a measure voters would have to sign off on at the ballot box. Such a move would be difficult to reverse and ensure that lawmakers would always have to find money to pay for the cuts. It's likely homeowners' school taxes wouldn't be completely wiped out right away, Quintero said, and would take years to do away with if voters said so. But voters could theoretically compel lawmakers to keep chipping away at property taxes, depending on how the constitutional amendment is worded, he said. For example, it might force lawmakers to put any state surplus toward further cutting homeowners' property taxes, Quintero said. Others worry legislators would likely have to cut elsewhere in the budget to continue funding tax cuts if the state's budget takes a hit as the result of a significant economic downturn. Halbrook, the fiscal policy expert, said, quote, "In that case, all bets are off. The legislature can and may choose to cut schools, health care, worker pay, infrastructure, or any other items to balance the budget," unquote. I've noted in the past that all Texas constitutional amendments are hard to reverse. That's the point, and is why voters should really take hard looks at any constitutional amendment propositions. I have no doubt that if Abbott and the Republican-dominated Texas legislature put this constitutional amendment proposition on the ballot, it would pass. Because when voters generally, and Texans especially, see any kind of tax cut on the ballot, it's like a dog seeing a squirrel or a cat seeing a bird. They let the shiny thing distract them without thinking about the consequences. But to paraphrase Dr. Ian Malcolm in Jurassic Park, your Republicans were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should. This is just another example of Republicans being all for local control until they're in a position to control local government. Nothing is more fundamental to local control than deciding how government revenue is to be raised, how much from which sources, and how it is spent. A state and local income tax, at least as an option, would be the most equitable way to raise government revenue. But Texas Republicans made sure that's unlikely to happen by getting a constitutional amendment passed that forbids a state income tax. Especially if property taxes are to be abolished, a progressive income tax should be substituted for it, ideally. Remember, as always, you get the government you pay for. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Articles and commentaries often include lots of internet links for those of you who want to dig deeper. We excerpt some stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. There's more information on our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and you can look for me on Threads and Blue Sky at Think Wing Radio. KPFT now has its own iPhone and Android apps, and you can download them from the Apple or Android stores. They allow easy listening live or from the KPFT archive. Next, on the subject of taxes from Wonkette.com, is a lighthearted but informative piece on a Massachusetts tax policy that many rich people and Republicans swear would be a disaster for any state or nation that does it. This is written in first person, so I'll read it that way. Massachusetts millionaire tax still going very well, thank you.
Last May, we were very happy to report that the millionaire tax instituted in the state of Massachusetts was working out very well, not scaring off all of their rich people and raising funds for necessary education and transportation initiatives. The state had raised $1.8 billion, $800 million more than they predicted, and none of the terrible things the naysayers had predicted happened at all. But how are things going a year later? Even better. The tax has now generated $3 billion more than expected for a total of $5.7 billion that has been spent on projects that are positively benefiting Massachusetts residents and, quote, being used to bridge repairs, bolster literacy programs, and address the transportation system's budget deficit, unquote. In case you need a refresher, the tax is a 4% tax on anything people make over $1 million. Yes, $1 million. This means that if you make $1,100,000, they will be taxed a whopping $4,000 extra. That's like a single Chanel bag. They can deal. And deal they have. Most of them, anyway. Bloomberg reports that although many millionaires, who still haven't left, have been pushing for state measures to end it, some are actually pretty okay with the situation. Said Sam Slater, a real estate developer who lives in the Boston suburb of Weston and pays the millionaire's tax, quote, "At the end of the day, I happen to believe it's a phenomenal place to live," unquote. He's staying put, his family has roots in the region, and they also like Boston's culture, sports teams, and seasons, Slater said. Josh Isner, president of taser manufacturer Axon Enterprise, Inc., said the millionaire tax makes it harder to recruit talent, particularly well-paid artificial intelligence specialists, to the Northeast hub the company opened in Boston last year. But the office is based in the city because, quote, "Boston breeds super talented people," he said last year. But they did find one guy who split. Robert Reynolds, 73, the former chief executive officer of Putnam Investments, has moved down to Florida, citing the millionaire tax and the Massachusetts estate tax as a concern. Other people, of course, might just call that retiring after the company you work for is acquired by another company. According to an admittedly sketchy-seeming website that I'm not going to link to because no one needs that many pop-ups, Reynolds has a net worth of $319 million. My heart is not exactly breaking for him and the 4% tax he would have to pay on any money he'd make over $1 million. I think he'd be okay, personally. The fact that the state generated more money in the second year of its millionaire tax implementation than in the first suggests that not too many people have gone the way of Bob Reynolds, even if, according to him, he hasn't, quote, "been to one meeting in Boston since this past where there haven't been a number of people saying they're moving out of the state," unquote. Sure, people complain. Rich people are always going to complain about taxes. But they never flee the way they threaten to, largely because whether or not they like to admit it, they prefer to live in the kinds of areas where things are made nicer by the taxes they don't want to pay. One of the biggest things that the low-tax hysterics refuse to or pretend not to get is that there is a reason why rich people and big corporations are still centered in higher tax areas. And it's because, really, what good is money if they can't actually do much of anything with it? Sure, there are some people who like the idea of living out in the middle of nowhere on a ranch with nature. There are guys in their 70s who want to just move to Florida and play golf, though they almost always live in gated communities there with enormous HOA fees that serve similar purposes as taxes. But clearly, a whole lot more people like living in places where there are things to do. For especially rich people, they want to be able to spend some money on nice dinners, on fashion that people are actually going to see and appreciate, on cultural activities, and on events. They want to be able to send their kids to a good school, public or private. This usually entails living at least somewhere near a city, and very frequently in a blue state. It's not just rich people, either. Many of the comedians who follow Joe Rogan to Austin now regret the move because, well, there's not enough for them to do, and power grid failures aren't as much fun as we guessed they thought they'd be. Corporations need to be situated near good colleges they can pluck from, where a lot of talent is located. Sure, they could move to a state with extremely low taxes and hope that other people will move along with them, but they'll be cutting their talent pool by a lot. People who don't have kids aren't going to want to move to places where there isn't anything to do, and smart people who do have kids don't want said kids learning all about how Jesus rode dinosaurs or being taught by random military personnel or their spouses who haven't even completed a bachelor's degree because so few actual teachers want to live in their state.
I think even successful people who lean conservative and might want those things for other people's children still want their own kids to be competitive. This is why rich people aren't going to flee New York City if Zohran Mamdani institutes something similar. There are people living in walk-in closets just to get to live there. I'm pretty certain that there are rich folks who will be willing to deal with an imperceptible tax increase to do the same. We're talking about people who pay $50,000 a year for preschool. They'll manage. And it's worth noting that, if they can't, it's hardly as though there are not people willing and able to step up and take their places and make just a pinch less than a bajillion dollars a year, because there are. Lots of them. It's also why they aren't going to flee the United States if Elizabeth Warren gets her way and a similar tax is implemented nationwide. Pretty much any other place they'd want to live would have higher taxes. The places with the highest quality of life in the world also tend to be the places with the highest taxes, and that is not a coincidence. You get what you pay for. Interestingly, I say that all the time. Continuing. But it's not just about how the millionaires and billionaires feel. It's about how everyone else feels, and 58% of the country would like to see taxes raised on those making more than $400,000 a year, including 23% who say they should be raised a lot. 63% say they want to see taxes raised on corporations. Hell, 43% of Republicans say that taxes on these groups should be raised. Maybe we could have nice things after all. You know, it's often said, I'll note, that the states are the test laboratories for national policy, so Massachusetts is effectively conducting a tax-the-rich experiment for the rest of us. What the Massachusetts experiment suggests is that if a place has a desirable quality of life, then a small tax increase on incomes over $1 million is not a deal-breaker and can lead to even greater improvements in the overall quality of life for all residents, not just the rich. So, thank you, Massachusetts. Speaking of Massachusetts, a story from WGBH that should have gotten much wider national coverage, immigrants kept from Faneuil Hall citizenship ceremony as feds crack down nationwide. Becoming a U.S. citizen takes years and involves immigrants acquiring a green card, extensive interviews, background checks, classes, and a citizenship test, which I'll note most Americans can't pass, by the way. The naturalization ceremony is the final step to the process where the oath of allegiance and a citizenship certificate are granted. Immigrants approved to be naturalized went to Faneuil Hall, known as the country's cradle of liberty, on Thursday, December 4th, for that long-awaited moment to pledge allegiance to the United States. But instead, as they lined up, some were told by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service officials that they couldn't proceed due to their countries of origin. The same situation is playing out at naturalization events across the country as USCIS directed its employees to halt adjudicating all immigration pathways for people from 19 countries deemed to be high risk. Said Gail Breslow, executive director of Project Citizenship, quote, "One of our clients said that she had gone to her oath ceremony because she hadn't received the cancellation notice in time. She showed up as scheduled, and when she arrived, officers were asking everyone what country they were from, and if they said a certain country, they were told to step out of line and that their oath ceremonies were canceled," unquote. That client, a Haitian woman in her 50s, has had a green card since the early 2000s and started working with Project Citizenship in January. She declined an interview request through Breslow. Breslow told GBH News, quote, "People are devastated and they're frightened. People were plucked out of line. They didn't cancel the whole ceremony," unquote. She said many clients with upcoming ceremonies and USCIS appointments have received cancellations via an online portal. She shared an example of the notices they're receiving, that there's a link to that in the article, which provide no further guidance or instructions. Breslow said, quote, "One person was, you know, asking, what did I do wrong? Why is this happening to me? And, you know, needed to be reassured that it wasn't anything she had done. This wasn't her fault," unquote. The ceremony, which usually involves immigrants having family and friends present to witness their life-changing moment, is usually presided over by a judge or a USCIS official. USCIS and the agency it falls under, the Department of Homeland Security, have not returned direct requests for comment about the Faneuil Hall ceremony. USCIS issued a press release on Friday saying that it is launching a USCIS vetting center in Atlanta for immigration and naturalization processes. Said USCIS Director Joseph B. Edlow in the statement, quote, "USCIS's role in the nation's immigration system has never been more critical. In the wake of several recent incidents of violence, including a foreign national attacking National Guard service members on U.S. soil, establishing this vetting center will give us more enhanced capabilities to safeguard national security and ensure public safety, unquote. Advocates are decrying the move, said Elizabeth Sweet, executive director of MIRA Coalition, quote, as an immigrant takes the oath of citizenship, it's a reflection and recognition of the tremendous sacrifice of time, energy, and financial resources they have made in the hopes of becoming a full member of our community and nation. To have that final step canceled is unnecessarily cruel and does nothing to make this country a safer place, unquote. The countries presently on a full travel ban list are Afghanistan, Myanmar, Chad, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Those on the partial ban list are Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. This story infuriates me. My wife and stepdaughter are both naturalized citizens, and I can say authoritatively that becoming a U.S. citizen is not quick, easy, or cheap. I also suspect that many, if not most, Americans could not pass the citizenship test on the first try. Many of the people I know are either naturalized citizens or longtime green card holders. The same may be true for most of KPFT's listeners, possibly whether they know it or not. When it comes to Trump and MAGA, the cruelty is always the point. As my friend T. Greg Doucette noted when this story was brought to my attention by his Facebook post, quote, a reminder that we just want immigrants to come here the right way, was always a lie, unquote. Trump and his maggots might as well dispense with the smokescreen and just admit that only white Europeans are welcome to immigrate to the U.S. And the irony, as someone pointed out in social media, is the question of why would white Europeans want to come here? In most of Europe, they have socialized medicine, quality transportation in the form of public mass transit, roads, trains, and many benefits subsidized by social democratic governments. Right now, the only impetus I can see for Europeans to come here is to get as far away from Russia as possible, but many might see that was fleeing the frying pan only to leap into the fire. The discrimination by the USCIS is deplorable, and yes, there's that word, and I hope that there will eventually be prosecutions for the fear, anger, and hardship they have unnecessarily provoked against so many innocent people. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT now has its own iPhone and Android apps, and you can download them from the Apple or Android stores. They allow for easy listening live or from the KPFT archive. KPFT is Houston's community radio, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible, and some may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. You can choose Think Wing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows because spreading the word helps us too. Next is a short article from AFP via Times of Israel that will require a commentary from me. Europeans demand U.S. security guarantees before Ukraine territorial concessions from Elysee. Europeans and Ukrainians are asking the United States to provide them with security guarantees before any territorial negotiations in Russian-occupied East Ukraine, the French presidency says. The Elysee says ahead of a Monday meeting in Berlin with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, other European leaders, and the heads of the EU and NATO, quote, we need full visibility on the security guarantees that Europeans and Americans can give to Ukrainians before any settlement on contentious territorial issues, unquote. See, I told you it was going to be short. I have just one response to this story. We can discuss further U.S. security guarantees when the U.S. fully implements its original security assurances as promised in the 1994 Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances.
As per Wikipedia, the memorandum said in part that it, quote, prohibited Russia, the United States, and the United Kingdom from threatening or using military force or economic coercion against Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, except in self-defense or otherwise in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. As a result of the memorandum and other agreements between 1993 and 1996, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons, unquote. Now, in fairness, elsewhere in the Wikipedia article, it clarifies that, quote, it is not entirely clear whether the instrument is devoid entirely of legal provisions. It refers to assurances, but unlike guarantees, it does not impose a legal obligation of military assistance on its parties, unquote. The article further states, quote, whether or not the memorandum sets out legal obligations, the difficulties that Ukraine has encountered since early 2014 may cast doubt on the credibility of future security assurances that are offered in exchange for non-proliferation commitments. Regardless, the United States publicly maintains that, quote, the memorandum is not legally binding, unquote, calling it a political commitment, and that's unquote for the whole Wikipedia statement. And the credibility of further assurances by the U.S. is the crux here. Whether the 1994 Budapest Memorandum is considered a legal treaty promising defense assistance or not, the wishy-washy on-again-off-again response from the U.S. to assist Ukraine's defense makes further U.S. assurances of questionable value. And there is an irony that this memorandum was signed in Budapest given U.S. history there. Depending on who you believe, the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 may have been inspired in part by inference of some Hungarian activists that the West would intercede on their behalf if they rose up against the Soviet-supported regime ruling Hungary at the time. The Wikipedia article I've linked to in this show post at thinkwingradio.com touches on this subject and U.S. rationales at the time for failure to aid the Hungarian revolutionaries. It's a long and, I think, fairly balanced discussion of the history of this event. In any case, it reflects again on implied or inferred U.S. commitments. How concrete must mutual aid language be for the U.S. to be fully committed to assurances of defense assistance for Ukraine? Would the U.S. find squirmy language in the event that such assurances were cited in demands by Ukraine or the EU for future defense assistance? And most importantly, can any U.S. treaty agreements be treated seriously in the absence of Senate approval? Under Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, the Senate must ratify international treaties negotiated by the President with a two-thirds vote before it becomes U.S. law. For decades now, U.S. presidents have avoided sending most treaties to the Senate in expectation that they would fail to pass with the required supermajority. In such cases, treaties have been treated as morally binding by the parties involved, essentially on the promise of that president and presumed to be morally binding on future U.S. presidents. I think it's fair to say that no country, including Ukraine and the European Union, will be foolish enough in the future to assume a treaty agreement is effective without Senate ratification. And perhaps not even then. That is among the worst damage that Trump has done to the international standing of this nation. It's a reason for Ukraine and the EU to be dubious of future U.S. defense commitments, and this next story amplifies that damage even further. I touched on this next story last week in a general discussion of another article. This next piece from War on the Rocks goes into significant detail and discussion of the strategy document itself and what it could mean for the United States going forward. It's called 10 Jolting Takeaways from Trump's New National Security Strategy. And FYI, I'm not going to be reading all the quotation marks, just many of them. The new National Security Strategy is out, and it's a shock to the system. It's not just the latest public articulation of principles, ambitions, and priorities around which the United States organizes its foreign policy. Instead, it reads like a manifesto for a radically different American project. It is narrower, more partisan, more inwardly focused, and more personalized than any of its predecessors. Below are 10 takeaways that matter for how the United States sees its role and place in the world. First, the strategy is overtly about this president and not the United States as such. Most national security strategies at least try to present the United States as a cohesive whole and leave domestic politics out of it. This one instead puts partisan divisions and the president himself front and center. It casts President Trump's second administration as an expansion of his first term, a necessary welcome correction that began ushering in a new golden age. It calls Trump the president of peace, leveraging his deal-making ability to personally secure unprecedented peace in 8 conflicts across the globe, including ending the war in Gaza with all living hostages returned to their families. In doing so, the document merges national strategy and political campaigning. This matters because when a national security strategy elevates the president as protagonist rather than the country, it blurs the line between institutional strategy and political messaging. That alters how allies gauge reliability, how agencies interpret guidance, and how adversaries assess continuity beyond one person. Second, it narrows American purpose to, quote, core national interests, unquote, and explicitly disavows the post-Cold War liberal order that the United States has built and led. The strategy defines foreign policy as the protection of core national interests and says that it is the sole focus of the document. It criticizes American foreign policy elites for chasing permanent American domination of the entire world and for tying the United States to so-called free trade, globalism, and transnationalism that allegedly hollowed out the American middle class and eroded sovereignty. I'll note there are a lot of air quotes in that last sentence, which you can see if you read this show post. There will be a lot more of those in the rest of the story. Continuing. Where previous strategies wrapped U.S. power in the language of democracy promotion and the rules-based order, this one is markedly different. It redefines leadership and power through coercive leverage, bilateralism, and transactional alignment. This is an America that is not necessarily retreating from the world stage, but consolidating its power through bullying and deal-making. I'll note that that sounds exactly like Trump's view of his so-called deal-making. Continuing. Third, immigration is elevated to the central national security problem. The text declares bluntly that, quote, the era of mass migration must end, and that, quote, border security is the primary element of national security, unquote. It frames mass migration as a driver of crime, social breakdown, and economic distortion, and calls for a world where sovereign states operate to, quote, stop rather than facilitate destabilizing population flows, unquote, and tightly control whom they admit. In effect, this makes border control and immigration enforcement the organizing lens for national security policy, not just one concern among many. This has acute consequences for military force posture, diplomacy, and resource allocation. If border security is top priority, then missions in the Indo-Pacific, Europe, and the Middle East become subordinated to hemispheric enforcement. More than a mere rhetorical shift, this strategy reorders the hierarchy of threats and danger. Fourth, a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine puts the Western Hemisphere first and implies the realignment of global force posture. The strategy states that the United States will assert and enforce a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine to keep the Western Hemisphere free of, quote, hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets, unquote, while ensuring stability sufficient to prevent mass migration and protect critical supply chains. It's unclear how Latin America figures into the plan, whether as an external partner region or lying within an extended U.S. security perimeter. The text foreshadows a readjustment of our global military presence away from theaters judged less central and toward hemispheric contingencies. There is a sharp hierarchy of regions. The Americas first, with Asia, Europe, and the Middle East explicitly important, but now competing against an official hemispheric priority. This is Monroe Doctrine logic repurposed for demographic control and economic nationalism. Fifth, protecting American culture, spiritual health, and traditional families are framed as core national security requirements. It is here where the influences of Christian nationalism and the vice president are the most apparent. The document insists that, quote, restoration and reinvigoration of American spiritual and cultural health, unquote, are prerequisites for long-term security and links this to an America that, quote, cherishes its past glories and its heroes, unquote, and is sustained by, quote, growing numbers of strong traditional families, unquote, raising, quote, healthy children, unquote. America is thus cast as defender of so-called traditional values, while Europe lacks civilizational self-confidence and Western identity, quote, unquote. The language of the document is not the typical passing nod to values and societal cohesion of previous national security strategies.
It redefines culture and family as explicit national security issues, which brings domestic cultural politics into the domain of national security decision-making. I'll add that, to me at least, this sounds like very 1930s fascist Übermensch language, but continuing. Sixth, the strategy elevates the culture wars into a governing logic for national security, and it does so through rhetoric that treats ideological and cultural disputes as matters of strategic consequence. The document denounces diversity, equity, and inclusion as a source of institutional decay and presents this as a national security problem. Yet the argument does not remain focused on personnel policy. It expands into a broader effort to define cultural cohesion, political identity, and even social change as indicators of strategic reliability. This is clearest in the European section, where the strategy suggests that some allies are drifting because of what it describes as failing political leadership, public dissatisfaction with policy toward the war in Ukraine, and supposed structural weaknesses in European democracy. The text also speculates about demographic and cultural shifts in Europe as a way to question whether future governments will share American views of their alliances. The strategy does not substantiate these claims. Instead, it uses them to imply that cultural alignment is essential for strategic partnership. What emerges is not a traditional assessment of allied capability or political will, but a cultural test for geopolitical trustworthiness. European governments seen as insufficiently responsive to public opinion are depicted as suppressing legitimate democratic impulses. Their policy disagreements with Washington are presented as evidence of deeper cultural or ideological drift. The strategy therefore treats internal political debates within allied democracies as matters for American scrutiny, while insisting on strict insulation of American domestic politics from foreign influence. This asymmetry reveals a worldview in which cultural politics becomes an instrument of statecraft. It positions the United States to judge the internal order of its partners through the lens of ideological compatibility rather than institutional capacity or shared interests. In doing so, the strategy folds the culture war into alliance management and treats domestic cultural narratives as strategic tools rather than purely political ones. Seventh, the Golden Dome missile shield is identified as a strategic directive. The strategy calls for next-generation missile defenses, including a Golden Dome for the American homeland to protect the United States, its overseas assets, and allies. This is an ambitious vision of layered homeland missile defense that goes well beyond the traditional focus on limited protection against rogue states. In fact, it is a doctrinal pivot. If taken literally, it implies industrial commitment and immense investment. And what is the trade-off? Scaled back power projection? A smaller army? Any attempt at comprehensive missile defense destabilizes established nuclear deterrence logic. Pursuing it would trigger concerns in Moscow and Beijing that Washington seeks first strike advantage. Eighth, the long-running project of increasing burden sharing with allies evolves into burden shifting, anchored in the June 2025 Hague Summit pledge by NATO countries to spend 5% of GDP on defense. While past strategies have asked America's allies to do more, this one takes it to another level. Quote, "The days of the United States propping up the entire world order like Atlas are over," unquote, and touts a Hague commitment under which NATO countries, quote, "pledge to spend 5% of GDP on defense," unquote, a standard it says allies have endorsed and now must meet. This is more than arm-twisting and has implications for alliance cohesion. It treats compliance as a condition for political favor. If enforced, it would trigger severe budgetary and political shocks across Europe and beyond. Ninth, there is a harder-edged doctrine of sovereignty assertion paired with suspicion of international institutions. The strategy's principles stress the primacy of nations and vow to resist sovereignty-sapping institutions of the most intrusive transnational organizations, promising to reform those institutions so they assist rather than hinder individual sovereignty and further American interests. It also warns against foreign attempts to manipulate our immigration system to build up voting blocs loyal to foreign interests within our country. By framing diaspora politics as a national security threat, the strategy blurs the boundary between counterintelligence and domestic political competition, a move without precedent in prior national security strategies. The assertions about sovereignty in the text expose a double standard. America is not to be messed with, and yet the Trump administration sees no issue with inserting itself into the domestic political debates of allies, namely Germany.
Finally, economic nationalism and reindustrialization sit at the center of security strategy, not at the periphery. The document calls cultivating American industrial strength the highest priority of national economic policy, with a strong manufacturing base described as essential to both peacetime and wartime power. It promises to rebalance trade, secure critical supply chains in a Hamiltonian spirit so the United States is, quote, never dependent on any outside power, unquote, for key defense or economic inputs, and position the energy sector as the leading export engine. Industrial policy, tariffs, and supply chain controls are therefore not separate from strategy. Rather, they are central instruments of statecraft on par with traditional military tools. Herein lies contradictions. Tariff-driven reindustrialization requires massive federal outlays, while the strategy also demands an enlarged defense budget, and never dependent on any outside power is materially impossible in some sectors, such as pharmaceutical precursors, cobalt, and rare earths, without reshaping global markets. Together, these takeaways point to a national security strategy that fuses America First economic and immigration policy, an assertive hemispheric doctrine, and domestic political objectives into a single organizing framework. That said, it's unclear how much this matters in practice. All the principles put forth in the strategy have been said before by the president and his inner circle. For both allies and adversaries, though, the shock is not only the specific policies, but the message that the United States now sees its security in a more personalized, inwardly focused, and narrower way than before. As I've said many times over the last decade, Trump and his cronies and manipulators and his Republican Party sycophants are doing lasting damage to the United States and its role in the world. A role that we have built and maintained for the better part of the past century, and which has kept the nation reasonably safe and secure. Unfortunately, I can't say it's kept us at peace, but that's largely the fault of poorly chosen leadership on the part of American voters. Some U.S. wars since 1945 were fought with varying degrees of necessity or strategic purpose, but even then they were sometimes fought with poor strategic vision. Further, I think that U.S. wars lasting 20 years, especially wars of questionable strategic necessity, are both intolerable and inexcusable. And even with all that said, I cannot see this new so-called security document making us, our allies, or the world at large safer. In fact, I think it will do the reverse. All you have to do is look at the implicit threat of a U.S. invasion of Venezuela as an example. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Mondays at 2 p.m. and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. Articles and commentaries often include lots of internet links for those of you who want to dig deeper into stories. We excerpt most articles, so I link to the full stories on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. KPFT finally has its own Apple or Android app, and you can download them from the Apple or Android stores. Either app allows easy listening live or from the KPFT archive. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. Again, that number is 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Blue Sky at Think Wing Radio. Next, from the New York Times, U.S. boarded a ship and seized cargo heading to Iran from China. A U.S. Special Operations team boarded a ship in the Indian Ocean last month and seized cargo headed to Iran from China, a U.S. official said, a rare operation at sea aimed at blocking Tehran from rebuilding its military arsenal. The seizure, which was first reported by the Wall Street Journal, occurred amid a strategic stalemate between Iran and the United States over its nuclear weapons program. Iran faced off against Israel and the U.S. in a short war this summer that killed more than 1,000 people over 12 days of intense long-range missile and airstrikes. A fleet of U.S. stealth bombers struck Iranian nuclear facilities during that war, an attack that U.S. officials said had significantly degraded Iran's nuclear weapons program, but regional officials and analysts fear that a renewed conflict is inevitable.
The United States had been tracking the shipment as it made its way from China to Iran, the U.S. official said, on condition of anonymity, and the ship was sailing several hundred miles off the coast of Sri Lanka when the U.S. Operations Forces launched the operation. The commandos boarded the ship and confiscated its cargo before letting the vessel proceed. It was unclear what exactly the ship was carrying, but the cargo, the official said, consisted of dual-use components that could be used either for civilian applications or to make conventional weapons. The boarding occurred several weeks before the recent seizure of an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. A spokesman for the United States Indo-Pacific Command, which oversees military operations in the regions, declined to comment. Iranian factories are working around the clock to replenish stockpiles of long-range missiles and drones that can be used to strike Israel. In the war this summer, Iran had sought to overwhelm Israel's air defense network through sheer numbers and will likely seek to import components to build as many new weapons as possible ahead of a renewed conflict. The United States has increasingly sought to control the delivery of dual-use goods, especially the microelectronics and software needed to manufacture guided weapons systems and remote drones. Many of these components are much harder to explicitly ban or embargo because of their plausible use in non-military applications. Over the course of the war in Ukraine, U.S. officials have sought to interrupt the supply of these goods being shipped from firms in China to Russia, but that effort had never escalated to launching military operations against commercial shipping traffic. About that last point, as adjacent countries, China can ship components to Russia by overland and mail routes that the U.S. can't possibly interdict. Everything I'm going to say now requires that I stipulate in advance that I only have limited lay knowledge of international law supplemented by Google. Acts of war have gotten harder to define. I confirmed this by searching for definitions. Formal declarations of war would make the distinction simple, but to my knowledge, no nation has officially declared war on another nation since 1945 when the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. In our modern world, wars just sort of happen. In the absence of formal declarations, I think that military invasions or attacks can be clearly seen as acts of war, but what about so-called gray warfare tactics? I've provided an explanatory link for that term in this show post. Such tactics have been used increasingly by actors such as Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and others. Gray zone tactics are used because they are seen as below the threshold of so-called kinetic military retaliation, but they do real damage at various levels of severity. Gray zone warfare can also be hard to attribute. Were actions committed by a national actor, a rogue non-national group, or simply criminals? At whom should a retaliatory response be aimed, and of what kind? On the other hand, physical searches and seizures of ships at sea could be seen as a more tangible act of war. The U.S. has interfered with international shipping at least twice in the last months on grounds that may be legally questionable. The War of 1812 was caused partly by British interference with U.S. shipping on the high seas and impressment of U.S. sailors into the British Navy. Compare this with the U.S. stopping a ship on the high seas and confiscating all or some of its cargo as happened in the Indian Ocean and with a Venezuelan contracted oil tanker. And what nation is this act committed against? The Venezuelan tanker skipper was flying the flag of Guyana but is not actually registered there. As of this writing, I can find no information on where this ship is actually registered or who owns it. The same goes for the ship intercepted by the U.S. in the Indian Ocean that was traveling from China to Iran with dual-use cargo believed to be intended for Iranian military hardware. I can't find any mention of where that ship is officially flagged or even its name, but it raises the same questions. Who are these acts committed against, and who, if anyone, should retaliate against the U.S. and how? The nation of registry? The persons or companies who own the ship? The owners of the product seized? The country of origin? The nation or companies of destination? Some or all of the above? I remember reading many years ago that military blockades, such as the one we put around Cuba in 1962 and which China may employ against Taiwan at some future date, are technically acts of war. And yet, in the absence of a formal declaration, do they cross a threshold of military retaliation in the absence of an actual attack on territory? Is stopping a ship and seizing cargo on the high seas a form or part of actual blockade, or just a one-off interdiction? The U.S. is on very shaky legal ground here, but while these actions are more obvious, the U.S. is not alone. Acts of war are getting much trickier to define in the modern age, and that's a bad thing. There is no question in my mind that at some future time it's essential that an international treaty, possibly under the auspices of the UN, such as the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, must be negotiated to more clearly define what constitutes modern acts of war so as to remove the gray zone of responsibility. Unless that happens, these hard-to-define acts of aggression will continue to proliferate. And finally, in a story about slapping back at Trump's ego, there's this story from the sfgate.com. This artist created a workaround to Trump's face on national parks passes. In response to the Department of the Interior's announcement that designs on newly issued America the Beautiful passes will include President Donald Trump's face, one artist has taken matters into her own hands. Jenny McCarty, an ecologist and watercolor artist in Colorado, announced on Wednesday that she is selling stickers that cover up the controversial and allegedly illegal new designs on the front of the passes, which include Trump's face next to a painted rendering of George Washington. McCarty's stickers are adorned with her own artwork of landscapes and animals at various parks. One features a pika standing at the famous Rock Cut overlook in Rocky Mountain National Park with an alpine flower in its mouth. Another shows a wolf howling on the banks of the Snake River with the Teton Range looming in the background. The third is of a grizzly bear looking out over a vast expanse in Denali National Park and Preserve. McCarty told SFGate, quote, "The National Park Pass is a pass to essentially heaven on earth for most of us, and I think that it's important to have beauty on the pass," unquote. Over 100 orders have been placed over the last 2 days, McCarty said, which shocked her. She said, quote, "I'm definitely surprised, and we're a small business, so it's going to be a lot of volunteer hours dedicated to packaging everybody's order, but it's all for a good cause," unquote. The stickers are being sold through McCarty's business page, Sage Leaf Studio, and are going for $6 a pop. All profits made from their sales will be donated to the National Park Foundation and the National Parks Conservation Association, she said. To make sure the stickers wouldn't interfere with any of the pass's official uses, McCarty made calls to several visitor centers at various national parks. She said that most of the employees she spoke with told her they couldn't offer any official guidance on the topic, but suggested that since signatures and barcodes are located on the backs of the passes, placing stickers on the front should be acceptable. However, in the event that new guidance is released regarding the passes in 2026, McCarty said that an easy solution might involve placing the passes in clear credit card cases and adhering the stickers to the front of them. McCarty said, quote, "So worst case scenario, you could remove your park's pass and show that it isn't altered in any way, but it covers up the image that people maybe don't want to see," unquote. McCarty has been creating art for most of her life, but began painting consistently 3 years ago as a way to honor her creative pursuits outside of her career as an ecologist and natural resources manager. This endeavor blossomed into Sage Leaf Studio, which sells prints and paintings depicting majestic landscapes and animal life. McCarty said, quote, "I use my art to inspire people to care about wildlife and wild places and to remind everyone why they're worth protecting," unquote. This story has pictures of the optional stickers that can be used to cover Trump's face. I'm also providing a link to a separate story that shows the card with Trump's orange visage. Remember that defiance of authoritarianism is made up of many different kinds of acts of protest and resistance. That's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community radio. I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
We have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late, we should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late, not while we're living.
90.1 FM, listener-sponsored and commercial-free, where you'll hear less talk and more music. KPFT, your Houston community station.
I asked what kind of family she wanted. She said, a family like yours.
Learn more about adopting a teen at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward.